this case, the statistics are simply undeniable. We've talked about it many times here on Issues, Etc. In fact, I think it's probably formed part of a conversation on this program more often than not. The decline of mainline liberal denominations in the United States, and the statistics are shocking. I mean, if a business was declining at the rate that many of the mainline liberal denominations have declined in the last 30 years, CEOs would be fired hand over fist, and there would be an outright call for radical change. Well, in the liberal denominations, there is an outright call for radical change, but it's always in the same direction, toward more theological and moral compromise. We're going to be talking about the decline of mainline Protestantism here in the this hour of Issues, Etc. David Shiflett joins us. He's authored this book called Exodus, Why Americans Are Fleeing Liberal Churches for Conservative Christianity. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Our call-in number during this hour, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Listeners with the best questions or comments will get the book, Exodus, Why Americans Are Fleeing Liberal Churches for Conservative Christianity. Its author, David Shiflett, is our guest. He's a member of the White House Writers Group. Dave, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Dave, in your research for this book on the decline of mainline liberal denominations, what was your most surprising story from liberal Christianity?
Todd, I'll tell you, there were a lot of these stories were just kind of, to me, were kind of funny. Let me tell you one. I interviewed a liberal Episcopal priest, and he confided in me, and he told me that the money behind the American Anglican Council, which is the group of dissenting Episcopalians who are leaving over the Gene Robinson ordination, he said this money was being provided by somebody with theocratic intentions. You know, I was thinking to myself, the whole idea of Episcopalians establishing a theocracy is so crazy. I mean, if you believe that, you'll believe that the Kiwanis Club is going to take over America via military takeover. I mean, but that's kind of show you the level of hysteria that you encounter sometimes on the left.
Do the proponents of the further move toward the left in liberal denominations, do they see what's happening? Do they see sometimes a 30% decline in their numbers as evidence that they're going in the wrong direction?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that they believe this is separating the wheat from the chaff. That was the impression I got from interviewing people on the left, which I interviewed a lot. But that was kind of that they were going in the right direction and that eventually people would follow. But, you know, the evidence is all in the other direction. You know, I mean, if you just look across the roster of mainline liberal churches, they're all sinking. You know, well, they're not sinking fast, but they're certainly losing a lot of members. Of, you know, the United Church of Christ, for instance, has lost, I think, 30,000 members in the last year, and they are very politically liberal. I mean, they're saying we must divest in Israel, that Israel must stop building its wall, there must be gay marriage, we must never privatize Social Security. And, you know, people don't go to church to hear their pastor talk about that sort of thing. I mean, they go to church to hear, you know, the Christian message. And a lot of times in liberal churches, they're looking up at the pulpit and SpongeBob is up there kind of proclaiming, you know, the latest virtues of the day. And so, you know, in response to that, people just leave.
So paint a picture for us of the kind of decline we're looking at. Where do you locate it? And what denominations seem to be suffering the most from this exodus, from this war of attrition?
Well, the Presbyterian Church, USA, has certainly suffered, you know, significant loss over the last 10 years. United Church of Christ has. Of course, Episcopal Church is just withered away to almost a postage stamp size. But most of the mainline denominations are just losing. I mean, and if you look on the other side, the more conservative bodies seem to be growing quite rapidly. The Southern Baptists, for instance, have been doing very well, you know, over the last several decades. Very smaller denominations, you know, this, the whole panoply of them are gaining members.
What are the issues that seem to be common to the church bodies that are in severe decline?
Well, you know, obviously there's sexual issues. I mean, and that's been going on for you know, quite a while. And if you take the Episcopal Church, for instance, the first two chapters I did in this book were with the Episcopal Church and interviewing people on both sides. My observation on that was, of course, the thing that's been in the news lately has been the ordination of Gene Robinson. But, you know, before that, there were accommodations, which to me were much more significant as far as theology goes. I mean, for instance, you've had bishops in the Episcopal Church that deny the resurrection of Christ, which, you know, is an unusual thing for a bishop, you would think, in a Christian church to deny. You know, and when you remove the Easter hope from the Christian message, what's left? Really, not too much. And I think they lost people over that. They lost people over female ordination in that church, divorce and remarriage, and now homosexuality is obviously a flashpoint, not only in that church, but the Presbyterian Church and the Methodist Church.
We often interview leaders of reform groups within mainline Protestant liberal denominations, the very ones you've been mentioning here, and the reform groups are often guests on this program. I will always ask this question. How did it get to this point? How did it get to the point where you are considering leaving? How did it get to this point? What kind of answers are you getting to that question?
Well, you know, I think a common thing that happens with people is that, you know, they grow up, they grew up in church, they get the basic Christian message, they saw it starting to slide. They would hang in there. I mean, sometimes people, you know, there'd be a certain subject that came up that they just couldn't abide. But what seemed to be a kind of constant thread with people I interviewed was that they had children, and they weren't sure that their children would, you know, be raised in a Christian church that would, you know, stress the basis of it. I mean, because you can certainly go into liberal churches and still find many priests, pastors who are you know, preaching the resurrection, for instance. But they're also preaching, you know, doctrine, which actually is a changed doctrine that strays far from the basic Christian message. So these parents were concerned that their kids wouldn't get a solid basis, so they went to a more traditional church where they felt they didn't have to worry about that as much.
You also talk quite a bit in the book about John Shelby Spong, at one time the Bishop of Newark in the Episcopal Church USA, kind of the poster child for what's going on in some of these denominations. Tell us about it.
Well, he was an interesting guy, very, very bright, he's just a great interview. You know, if you're in the media, especially the mainstream media, I mean, he's just, you know, he's one talking point after the other. But he does not believe that God is a supernatural being. What that leaves God, I don't know, but he doesn't believe that Jesus rose from the dead. I believe he's the one who called most prayers or adult letters to Santa Claus. And, you know, those are beliefs that, you know, some people have, but you wouldn't expect those in a bishop in a Christian church. And there are differences in other bishops as well, but, you know, the thing is once you accommodate that, you know, I mean, what's left? And there were a lot of Episcopalians who began leaving after that. Now, one I interviewed named Andy Ferguson, who was a writer that many of your listeners may know. He writes for the Weekly Standard, TV Guide, and several other publications. Anyway, he was in an Episcopal seminary in Berkeley, California. He was a student there. He wasn't a seminarian, but he was taking classes there. And he used to argue basic Christian doctrine with a favorite professor. And Andy would basically defend the idea that, you know, Christianity was based on biblical truth. And the professor would, you know, would argue from the other side, saying, oh, these are just fables and myths, and, you know, they have their purpose, but they're not to be taken too seriously. So one day Andy was in the cafeteria having a bowl of soup, and a student walked up to him and said, we finally figured out what your problem is. You're the only one here who believes in God. And by what he meant by that was that Andy's the only one who believed in the traditional God, and Andy said, you know, he was right, because they would believe in a redemptive power in the universe and this sort of gauzy sort of beliefs about God, but he was the only one who was kind of taking the traditional route. So he just left, and he eventually would convert to Catholicism about 2 years ago. And he won't be going back to, you know, liberal Protestantism, that's for sure.
On the issue, again, of John Shelby Spong, do liberals like him, kind of the ultra-arch-liberals like Spong and others, have they given cover to less liberal churchmen in the same church bodies to kind of say, hey, yeah, I might be liberal, but I'm no Spong, and therefore they kind of have more staying power?
Well, I think that's probably true to an extent, but I mean, there are just a lot of liberal Episcopal priests. I mean, that's, you know, that's warm water for that sort of person to swim in. So, if there's some outsider that's, you know, ribbing them too hard, they can say that. But what I found was interesting was that the extent to which beliefs that you might associate with John Selby Spong have actually filtered down through, you know, the Christian ranks and the rank and file. Even amongst people who are born-again Christians, for instance, who, you know, we are told are no different than fundamentalists, I mean, there's a great deal of what you could call theological heterodoxy there. In other words, they don't go down the list of Christian tenets and hold to them. Let me give you some examples. About 30% of born-agains, according to Barna research in California, don't accept physical resurrection. Around 40% don't believe in Satan as a, you know, as a being, or the Holy Spirit as a living being. So those are ideas that I think, you know, do filter down from the top, and I was very shocked to see those kind of numbers, but you know, Barna has done a great deal of research into those areas, as has Pew Research.
You talk early in the book about kind of the creed of liberal Christianity being tolerance. What does it mean in those circles, this word tolerance?
Well, I think it means the same in those circles as it does in political circles. It means people who agree with me. Basically what tolerance is. And I mean, there's tolerance for some things and intolerance for others. But, you know, basically these days when you talk about tolerance, it's usually about sexual matters. I mean, that's kind of the flashpoint right now. And there's, you know, there's a great deal of dispute over that, and I guess there will continue to be, but it does provide one of the dividing line issues. So, you know, I found that in my research and interviews with people who are more evangelical and Southern Baptists and Aaron people, that there's a great deal more tolerance on that side than you would ever gain from the mainstream media, and some of it is quite profound. I did one chapter in the book on Columbine. I have a special interest in that. That was my neighborhood, and our family lived there for 6 years. We left before the killings, thank goodness, but that was our neighborhood school, and there were many people there. In fact, my youngest son was an associate of Dylan Klebold's, who was one of the killers. And I had met a pastor there at the Foothills Bible Church, Bill Udemolin, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. But Pastor Bill was a very dynamic evangelical preacher there, and I knew that he had conducted a service for one of his congregants who was killed in the high school library at Columbine. And I read his sermon, and I read several other sermons that were given in Columbine the week after the killing, that Sunday, and in the weeks to come. And what I found in there was very interesting. There was a constant theme in these sermons, and it was that although Klebold and Harris had done monstrous things, that they should not be considered monsters. And there was the old idea of love the sinner but hate the sin. And I thought that was an incredibly generous and, you know, to be sure, tolerant attitude considering the nature of those crimes. And that seemed to permeate that community. And I think that's a great, you know, bow in the direction of these evangelical people who suffered something so horribly but still had in their hearts to be concerned about the perpetrators. That's tolerance, in my view, of, you know, the first stripe.
We're talking with David Shiflett about the decline of mainline Protestantism. He's author of several books, including his latest, Exodus, Why Americans Are Fleeing Liberal Churches for Conservative Christianity. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. So one of the dividing lines here appears to be two different definitions of tolerance that are at work in American Christendom.
True, yeah. And I'll tell you, I think that there's something that kept coming back to me was that there's just a different view of God. I think. I mean, in some of the liberal churches, you know, the God just is not the God that you encounter, or I think you encounter in the Old and New Testaments. I mean, you're probably aware of the process theologians who have whittled God down to 30% of his original strength. They had this formula for that we don't need to go into, but the result is a God who just, you know, probably couldn't even fix a parking ticket. You know, I mean, it's this kind of very distant, you know, guy that you have in for weddings and christenings and stuff. But, you know, and I think most Americans aren't interested in getting up Sunday morning to go to a church where that sort of God is presented. I mean, they want a God made of sterner stuff, and you do find that God much more prevalently presented, you know, in the traditional churches. And there's also, you know, there's a different view of the nature of man, I think. And, you know, we've been talking about sexual issues, which certainly are flashpoint issues in religion as they are in, you know, the culture at whole. But, you know, I think the traditional view, traditional Christian view, was that people are spiritual beings that have, you know, sexual impulses that need to be controlled. And I think the more secular view is that people are sexual beings that have religious impulses that need to be controlled. I think it kind of divides that way in a lot of cases. And we do live in an era of you know, where self-expression is at the heart of our experience. And so the whole idea of restraint and living by these old rules is anathema to a lot of people, including a lot of church people.
One of the things that I found very interesting, I've noted it, especially with regard to the Episcopal Church USA, and not so much with the other mainline denominations, but especially with kind of the Anglican end of American liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, while, and this is not uniformly true, but while they abandon theology almost wholesale, you can walk into their churches and they're still worshiping the way Anglicans who believe all this stuff do. But the words all have different meanings. They are very, in the case of Episcopalians, many of them, very liturgical and very traditional, and they even say the creed, although one wonders whether they believe it.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I found the same thing to be true. In fact, I interviewed a priestess, I guess you could call her. She's just a marvelously smart woman, very engaging, great speaker. I mean, she could deliver a great sermon. In fact, of all the preaching I heard for this book, she was probably the best preacher I heard. And she, you know, she was a priest at an Episcopal church in Richmond, Virginia, which it's probably 20% gay. That was her number. And so they're on that side of that issue. So I asked her some theological questions, you know, what exactly do you believe? And I got to the resurrection. I said, do you believe in the resurrection as a something that happened physically? And she replied, yes, I do. There was bodily integrity. So I said, well, maybe she's just telling me that because, you know, I'm in her office and door's shut and who knows who's listening. So I came back Easter morning, though, just to check it out, and she preached a very, very compelling Easter service. I mean, it was the good hope, the good news. So, you know, there's sort of an incoherence, I think. And of course, in the Episcopal service, they sing the Nicene Creed, which is, you know, the foundational creed of the religion. And so I think what happens is that, you know, that stuff, the old stuff is there. Maybe the older people take it more seriously than some of the younger people do. And then you have the sermons, which can say anything. I mean, you just never know what these guys are going to come up with. And that's, again, that's why I think, I know, for instance, I interviewed Frederica Matthews Green. You may be familiar with her.
Sure, she's been a guest on the program.
And her husband, Gary, who's Reverend Greg now, Pastor Greg, they left the Episcopal Church. And the reason they left was because the children, they said, you know, we just don't know what they're going to hear in Sunday school. I mean, we just can't trust it to be a coherent Christian message throughout these churches. Because you certainly can go to many Episcopal churches, and you can walk in there, and it's like old times. But then the next week, you don't know what they'll be proposing. So, I mean, I think people are looking for consistency.
We recently interviewed John Shelby Spong, and when I presented him with kind of a basic creedal faith, just kind of an outline of what the creed essentially says about God and man, his response was, you know, I treasure that as the tradition in which I was raised.
Right.
A heritage that I value kind of like fond childhood memories.
Right.
But not really any tangible belief in it. Is that pretty typical?
Yeah, I'd say so. You know, and I often thought, you know, before I started interviewing some of these folks with, you know, perhaps that they, you know, they grew up in with religion. They got to a point where they really couldn't believe it believe it anymore, but they weren't strong enough to break free of it. You know, they wouldn't walk on their own. But then, you know, it seemed to me more people I interviewed, I think they just became convinced that was okay up to a point, and now we've evolved to the point where that's no longer true, and that they are actually doing the new missionary work in Christianity. So, you know, I think there's a certain fervor and certainly a great deal of devotion to the innovations they've come up with. You know, so it's but they certainly have discarded a great deal of the tradition. Part of the book, I went and dissected a sermon that was given in support of the ordination of Gene Robinson, which, as I say in the book, to me is small potatoes compared to what already happened in the Episcopal Church.
Sure.
But, you know, my question to these priests was, how can you just kind of read the stuff that's in the Bible that, you know, your traditions always said is true and then say, well, this isn't true anymore? And so, the explanation was uniform. They'd say, look in the Old Testament. There are passages in there about stoning unruly children. Now, do you believe that? And there's a person will say, well, no, I don't believe we should stone unruly children. They said, then you shouldn't believe these other passages in the New Testament. So what happens is that the Old Testament is often used to neutralize the New Testament, and there's a void left there, and then the new virtue is inserted, you know, and that's the way they operate.
These liberal churches are pretty famous for making rather loose ecumenical relationships with one another in order to make a statement of unity to the world. They say, look, we've got to present a unified front to the world. How do they explain their declining numbers?
Well, you know, I talked to a couple people about that, and they do seem to think that they're kind of at the vanguard of the new truth, or that they've got the serious Christians, you know, with them, you know, the people who are continuing the tradition of, you know, Christian revolution. And Christ was obviously a revolutionary person, but, you know, they now are the revolutionary people. And so they have a very firm sense of mission about that, and the numbers really don't matter. I mean, you can talk to them and, you know, you say, you guys are talking yourselves out of business here. I mean, you're driving everybody out. And they say, well, we're just, you know, it's a wheat and the chaff situation. So, that you know, then if you press them, they'll say, you know, Jesus started off with only 12, you know. So I guess they figure they can talk the congregation down to 12 when they're, you know, in good company.
Folks, I'd love to hear from the members of the United Methodist Church or the United Church of Christ or the Episcopal Church USA, the Presbyterian Church USA, as we talk with Dave Shiflett about the decline of mainline Protestantism. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. This break is a great time to call, 1-800-730-2727. Listeners with the best questions or comments will get the book. Dave is its author. It's called Exodus, Why Americans Are Fleeing Liberal Churches for Conservative Christianity. When we come back, where are they going? If this is a war of attrition and people are falling by the wayside, where do they end up when they flee from liberal Christianity? We'll talk about several of the roads that they take to Rome. They go east. Sometimes they go south to Louisville. We already mentioned the Southern Baptist Convention, now the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S., growing and growing and growing. Is this part of the reason? We'll talk about it when we come back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. An acquaintance told me about a conversation he had with a minister. "I'm a lifelong Christian," said my friend. But the minister objected, and rightly so. No one is born a Christian. A Christian can be defined as someone who knows, accepts, and trusts the forgiveness God gives through Jesus and all the blessings that flow from that gift. No one is born knowing that. And without that, you are not a Christian, at least not in the biblical sense. Hebrews 11:6 says, "Without faith it is impossible to please God." If this faith comes, it's sometime after birth. Perhaps it comes weeks later through God's miracle of baptism. Perhaps decades later when the good news of Christ gets into your head and the Spirit takes it down into your heart. Romans 10:17 says faith comes from hearing the message, and the message is heard through the word of Christ. Summer slows us down. And not as much as decades ago, but most of us still get significant downtime these months. Since Christianity is something that comes to us, an alien invasion, you might say, summer is one of the best times of all to crack open a Bible, a devotional book, and let the outside goodness of God invade. Psalm 46, verse 11, "Be still and know that I am God."
Recently, police in Saudi Arabia raided a church and arrested 40 foreigners, including children who were worshiping Christ. This Global Minute urges you to pray for the strengthening of Christians in Saudi Arabia. The Associated Press reported that police raided a clandestine church gathering in the suburbs of Riyadh. Saudi law prohibits churches, although Christians who are citizens of other countries are normally allowed to gather in private homes. A police colonel reported that the meeting place displayed crosses, and a Pakistani man heard confessions and distributed communion. These believers could possibly be serving harsh prison sentences or facing deportation. Let this news move you to pray for a miracle in Saudi Arabia. Pray key decision makers will be faced with and embrace the love of Jesus Christ. God strengthens Christians, spreading His word in tough places around the world as you pray for them. Learn more on who needs prayer at the website missionvisionnetwork.org.
Dining with sinners. That's what happens every Sunday at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. The Lord Jesus Himself comes and spreads His banquet table before us, sinners, not a target group of professionals, but sinners in need of the one thing that only He can give, the forgiveness that He won for us at the cross. Christian, seeker, unbeliever, it doesn't matter. All those who are burdened by their sin and hungry for God's forgiveness are invited to visit Bethany Lutheran Church, 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the decline of mainline Protestantism. David Shiflett is our guest. You know, there is a place where pastors are being trained. One of the problems with the mainline denominations and their decline is their seminaries. They, take the Episcopal Church USA in 1976, decided that they would open the seminaries to the ordination of women and then to homosexuals. And these become seminaries. That means seedbed, a seedbed wherein a lot of things grew in that church and other churches. There is a seminary where men are being trained for the pastoral ministry in order to be faithful to God's word and to avoid an accommodation to the culture that is so common to mainline liberal Protestantism. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, a proud underwriter of Issues, etc. For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary, their toll-free number, 1-800-481-2155. 1-800-481-2155, or look for their logo at the homepage, issuesetc.org. That's our webpage, issuesetc.org. Dave, before we go on to talk about the avenues that conservatives are taking out of mainline liberal denominations, the roads that they are following out, another thing that I wonder if you found in your research in the mainline liberal denominations, and that is, and I heard this from Gene Robinson in an interview that he did on National Public Radio right about the time of his consecration. He said, look, the Spirit is doing a new thing. And all we're trying to do up there in New Hampshire is trying to follow where the Spirit is leading us. Did you hear that?
Yeah, that's kind of a common, common view. And you know, the problem with it is, I guess, you know, once you remove yourself from the traditions of the church, the Spirit, I guess, could take you anywhere. And that's, you know, that's the appeal that traditionalism has. I mean, I talked to person after person, said, you know, the reason we went to more traditional church, whether it's they went to Roman Catholicism or to Orthodoxy or Southern Baptist Convention, which, of course, has staked its future on inerrancy and done quite well as a result, is that, you know, they know what they're going to get. They know it's a constant, coherent message, and it's not going to change. And they believe that reflects, you know, the promise of Scripture that, you know, God is everlasting, everlasting, and what was said at the beginning of time or the beginning of humanity will carry through to the end. But, you know, the argument is, and I think it's a sound argument, if you just say the Spirit's moving as well, that's a pretty gauzy and a very, very flexible sort of way to be. And there are some people who are attracted to that, but in America there are not a lot of people who are attracted to that. That's why they're leaving those churches.
Let's talk about one of the avenues they're taking out of liberalism into more conservative waters, the first and probably the foremost being that toward Rome, toward Catholicism. But first, give us an accurate picture of especially American Roman Catholicism. It's often depicted as monolithic, very rigid, and very traditional in its theology.
Well, it's anything but, really. I mean, it's, you know, Rome has a long-standing tradition, as does Orthodoxy. Of course, Orthodoxy will say that their tradition is actually longer-standing than that. But, you know, there's a great deal of turmoil within the Catholic Church. I mean, the Catholic Church is home to some, you know, very left-wing people, good people. I mean, they apply their beliefs usually, you know, in terms of social welfare, and then you have a lot of conservative Catholics. So when I focused on those, I started off with the story of Andy Ferguson, the guy at the Episcopal Seminary who was the only guy who believed in God. He went there. Talked to him, but somebody I talked to who was immensely interesting to me was Father John McCloskey, who has been instrumental in bringing several high-profile conservatives into the Catholic Church, including Robert Bork, Robert Novak, Senator Sam Brownback. And I talked with him at length about, you know, why does his church appeal to these extremely smart, well-educated people? Because, you know, after all, that church basically nailed down its ideas for the age of science. And he pointed out that these are very intelligent people. The way he usually approaches it is to get them to read history, read theology, and see what conclusions they come to. And he's a very interesting guy, but he came up with a figure, and I'm sure you're aware of this, and also found it amongst Protestants. He said, you know, when it comes down to it, only about 10% of Catholics are with the program, as he called it. By that he meant that they go to Mass regularly, they go to confession, they try to conform themselves as much as possible to the Catholic teachings. I talked to Protestants, including Albert Mohler, you know, he gave me the same number. He said only about 10% of people really try to conform their lives to Christian the Christian message. So that was an interesting thing for me, because I had never heard people who are high ranking in an organization actually say that only 10% of the people are really with it. You know, that's breathtaking honesty in my view.
Do you think that if Rome compromised on issues like abortion, homosexuality, women's ordination, would you see conservative church bodies, otherwise conservative church bodies, following suit? Is Rome the Hoover Dam that's holding back on all those issues?
You'd see a lot of Catholics leave, I think. I mean, they would find another way, because they, you know, there are just a lot of Catholics who strongly believe that. I mean, there's some that want change, obviously, but I mean, you would see a schism there too. I certainly believe. I mean, in fact, McCloskey, I think, is. His line is, you know, female ordination. You know, he'll be out of there. I mean, I don't see that happening. I think the Catholic Church will actually become more conservative, as will Protestant Christianity, slowly but surely, for a couple of reasons. You're aware of the religious nature of Africa and the Southern Hemisphere. I mean, it's very conservative. Catholics, Pentecostals, you know, across the board, and Christianity is just exploding in those areas. You know, and that influence is going to eventually make its way. You know, Rome already is making its way to Rome. So I would expect for Catholicism to actually get more conservative, and like I say, Protestantism too. The other reason in the United States, from what I can tell, is that, you know, we're an aging population, and as you get older, which I certainly am, you know, moving along in years, and you begin thinking of the eternal, you know, situation, and traditional Christianity offers an unparalleled hope there for transcendence and for, you know, entering the kingdom of heaven. And so that, I think that message is going to resonate with more and more people. So I would assume that the strength of traditional conservative Christianity will in fact grow as our population ages.
Our call in number 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dave Shiflett is our guest, member of the White House Writers Group and author of several books, including his latest, Exodus, Why Americans Are Fleeing Liberal Churches for Conservative Christianity. We talked a little bit about Rome. Let's talk about the path toward orthodoxy that so many are taking, not only out of traditional liberal churches, but also out of evangelicalism. There has been a boon in at least American orthodoxy of late. What's attracting them?
You know, orthodoxy was a great surprise to me. I think I'm like a lot of Americans who have some interest in religion, at least. I knew very little about it. And so I interviewed Frederica and some other people and went to some services. And it is quite different from your typical Protestant service. I mean, you know, it's... In some of the churches, you stand the entire time. You've got the incense. You've got the beautiful music with all the minor scales. You have the liturgy that, as Father Gregory told me, you know, he said, we don't have a mechanism for changing this. He said, you know, even if somebody came along who wanted to liberalize our liturgy, there's just not a mechanism for doing so. I think people like that sense of constancy. And the Orthodox service... it's just mystical. I mean, that's the only way I can put it. I mean, it's quite different than what a lot of people are used to. And if they're looking for a strong Christian church that is also, you know, a breath of fresh air to them, I mean, I would highly recommend that church.
And then let's talk about Louisville, the Southern Baptist Convention, now 16 million strong and growing. In fact, it seems to be bucking the trend of most denominations, showing constant growth year by year. What's going on there?
Well, you know, what was really interesting about the Southern Baptist, I've interviewed Richard Land and Albert Mohler before for magazine work. And you know, there's an old saying in the political world that once an organization goes left, it's not going to go right again. I mean, it's, you know, if you're conservative, it's lost. But, of course, the Southern Baptist Convention's history is just the opposite. I mean, it became liberalized in the 60s, and conservative members said, you know, we're going to turn this thing around, and they did. And they staked their campaign on the issue of inerrancy, and they won. I mean, they basically began winning, you know, high church offices, and then they replaced liberal members of the seminaries, and they're a very solidly conservative church. And if you're looking for that kind of a church, that is definitely the place to go. And I think you can feel fairly confident that it's going to stay that way for a long time.
How much of a drawing card is someone like an Albert Mohler, who's been a guest on this program regularly? A man who is, how would you describe him, articulate, passionate, uncompromising, plus he's found a way to speak into the public square in a way that very few Southern Baptists like him have. How important is it for this giant Protestant church body that is gaining members to have a guy like a Mohler or a Land?
Well, they're both important. I mean, you know, there's a sort of a stereotype of Baptists, you know, that they're not very smart, you know, the Presbyterians and Baptists who learn to read. So what does that lead the Baptists? And, you know, they, you know, are, you know, they're just people who you don't want to associate with if you have any education, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, you know, Mohler and Land are, you know, just blazing examples. That's just not true. I mean, Mohler is a brilliant person. I mean, like you say, he isn't uncompromising. You can either like him or you're not going to like him. But at least he'll put his arguments forward very, you know, cogently, very straightforward, and he'll argue with you. I mean, he will... he will go into the public square and carry the fight. Land, you know, is also very intelligent, as he's, you know, fond of pointing out to people. He went to Oxford with Clinton, but he's the only one of the two who graduated. You know, he's a brilliant guy. He's much more politically interested, I think, than Mulder is. I mean, you know, Rich Land's in Washington all the time. He lobbies. He cajoles up on Capitol Hill. He's very articulate. He can be very funny. So, and like I say, he does go a long way toward demolishing the stereotype of Baptists as not being, you know, intelligent people, because he just, I mean, you don't get around him long and think that. You know, he's Princeton educated as well.
Then there is this very difficult, we can hardly find a city to describe. You, I mean, you've got Rome for the Catholics and Constantinople for the Orthodox, and you've got Louisville for the Baptists. When it comes to the evangelicals, I've talked to many people trying to get a definition of what evangelical is, and while there are sociological definitions, it's much more difficult to arrive at a theological definition for them.
Right.
But why are they attracting also refugees from liberal Christianity?
Well, you know, they are a very interesting group of people, and when you say group of people, that's using group, you know, in an expansive way, because, you know, a lot of evangelical churches, like I say, in the church in Columbine, you know, those churches, very, very, you just call them Bible-believing churches, you know, and you have that type of evangelical church, but you also have another type of evangelical church that is not outwardly Christian. You know, and I talked to Charles Colson. I interviewed him for this book. Who I think Colson's a great person. And you know, you talk about great second acts in America. I mean, you know, he's a phenomenal man, and you know, he knows the lay of the land in the United States as far as religion goes. And we were talking about evangelical churches and what they are. And he said, you know, the thing that he sees happening in a lot of these churches is that they're making the same mistake that the liberal churches made, you know, decades ago and have been making since. He said they basically, they're focusing not on the creator but on the creature. In other words, you go in and you know, you'll see a skit and they'll have some, you know, up-to-date music, and then they'll have this kind of feel-good sermon. He said that's not what Christianity is. He says, and this will carry people for a while, and actually it'll attract a lot of people because it's a good show. But in the end, it's not going to satisfy them, because it's not about, you know, following the Christian message of truth. It's more about making the, you know, the person feel good who comes in. And you know, some of these churches are just enormous. I'm sure you saw the New York Times story on the big church that just opened in Texas, Austin's church, with 16,000 people at a time, you know, attend those services. But there's no cross, no stained glass window, and some of the more conservative people have gone there and say, you know, this, it's not really necessarily a Christian message. It's a message of self improvement, of becoming successful, and in the end, that may be their undoing with the church.
So that might explain why we will find from time to time someone like a Joel Osteen. You just mentioned his Lakewood Church down in Houston, Texas,
right,
the largest megachurch in the United States. Saying things that sound so very similar to someone like a John Shelby Spong. John Shelby Spong wants to do away with the language of sin. I mean, he says the language of original sin and atonement that comes from Christianity is no longer operative. And Joel Osteen, I've got a quote from him here. Well, he'll say, well, we've heard a lot about the judgment of God and what we can't do and what's going to keep us out of heaven. It's time for people to start hearing about the goodness of God, a God that loves them, a God that believes in them, a God that wants to help them. And his message certainly very wrongly but honestly reflects that. Osteen ends up sounding a lot like Spong when it comes to issues like sin. Let's not talk about it.
Yeah, well, you know, sin is an interesting word. I mean, it sure scares a lot of people away. And if you're, you know, I think the traditional Christian message obviously is that we are all sinners. And if you do away with that portion of the message, you're going to appeal to a certain group of people. But I would suggest that people who are very serious about following, you know, the Christian way, and I'm, you know, I'm not any theologian, believe me, but you know, this is my observation. You've got to teach the whole package, or, you know, or forget it. It would be my, you know, advice. But I think people like Osteen, and there are a lot of people, you know, like him. Of course, he's probably the most successful, but they, you know, for whatever reason, I'm not saying it's being cynical, but they have come up with a formula that does draw a lot of people in. But as again, as Kelson pointed out, you know, that's not going to satisfy people forever, because there is the, you know, what's called the God-shaped void in the center of the human being, and this sort of thing isn't going to, you know, carry people through, especially when times get hard. You know, this is feel-good religion for feel-good times, I suppose.
Dave, you mentioned before that you think that Rome will probably grow more conservative, that American Protestantism outside the mainline denominations will probably grow more conservative. Will we watch a boiling down of the mainline liberal denominations? The more attrition there is of Orthodox Christians from their ranks, the more and more concentrated the liberalism becomes, like we're boiling the water off of syrup until it's rock-hard candy.
Well, you know, I think that's sort of the impression you get from talking to some, you know, liberal priests who you know, basically just say, look, you know, we are pursuing the Spirit, and we, of course, that is going to alienate some people. This is, you know, Jesus alienated people of his time. So, you know, they actually, it's like the old remnant idea, you know. I mean, they feel like they're, you know, they've got the core of the true serious believers. So, you know, I think that's the case. I just, you know, I don't think that, you know, for instance, the Episcopal Church is going to disappear. You know, I mean, I think it's down to 0.75% of the population. It'll probably grow small. It's a postage stamp size religion, and you know, the Unitarians are like a micro dot size religion, and I mean, these are, you know, numerically they're not large, but they, you know, they, a lot of intelligent people in those churches. They're very media savvy, so I mean, they're going to be around, you know, I guess indefinitely. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball here, but I do think that the traditional churches will continue to prosper. You know, and there are so many different sorts of Christian churches. I mean, you know, it's just hard to keep up with a number of them. And I mean, if you just think of all the different sorts of Pentecostal churches, for instance, and you know, Pentecostalism is a many varied thing too. But there's America, you know, we're sort of a market-driven people, and if there's enough people who believe something, a church is going to, you know, be created to serve that community. But overall, I would say that the trend is definitely going to strengthen the traditionalist Christian view of God and man.
I have cast about for some years here doing this radio program for a definition of liberalism that is not necessarily tied to any particular issue, because I think that tends to lead people on a wild goose chase sometimes. So what is liberalism? And recently, a regular guest on the program, Dr. Gene Edward Veith, who's culture editor for World Magazine, suggested, you know, at its heart, liberalism is changing your theology and practice to fit the spirit of the age or what the culture is doing. Is that a pretty good definition as far as you're concerned?
I think that's certainly true with regards to religion. You know, I mean, liberalism is not, you know, actually a bad word. I mean, you know, especially in the political realm, I mean, liberals have done great things in politics. But I think you are right. There's the sense in theological liberalism is that what has been, we have evolved to a higher state, and it's time to bring religion with us, you know. So it's the idea that the new theology can kind of be a co-creator and be a force that brings, as Spahn would say, would bring Christianity into the modern age. I think that's one of his, you know, expressions. And the other side is the truth of Christianity is not unchanging. It's the same age to age, and so we'll stake our, you know, eternal future with that belief. And I think that is the divide, you know, roughly speaking.
Finally, you write as a reporter after kind of surveying what's going on in liberal Protestantism and those who are leaving and those who are staying. You say that religion continues to be the story of stories. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, religion, I mean, just in general, is just, I mean, it's just so immense that, you know, I'm sure you probably know Terry Mattingly, the religion columnist. He calls us the God beat. But, I mean, there's, you know, religion in America is so varied. I mean, there's so many different sorts of religion, so many different types of Christian religion. Plus, you know, then you have Islam. You just have, you know, this reflection of the human desire to, you know, to know the Creator, you know, one way or the other. You know, you can put it many different ways, but that's an unchanging desire in humanity. And you just have all these stories that come up, you know, all the time. And some of them are quite breathtaking. I ended my book with a story of the former followers of Pol Pot, who, of course, committed a massive atrocities in Cambodia.
We've got about 30 seconds.
And so many of them have now converted to evangelical Christianity. It's just, you know, you say, how could that happen? And that's, you know, that's a big story to see changes that significant in individuals and also in societies.
1-800-737-0172 is the phone number for our resource line. You can use that number to request a free complimentary copy of our Next Issues, Etc. journal, or to make a tax-deductible credit card gift to help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc. By the way, no gift is too small. 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Dave Shiflett is a member of the White House Writers Group and author of several books, including his latest titled Exodus, Why Americans Are Fleeing Liberal Churches for Conservative Christianity. Dave, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
You know, the definition, I think, probably can be run either way. You can either look at the issues and you can say, look at what the church is here in mainline liberal Protestantism have denied and look at the consequences of it. Or you can take that broader definition that liberalism is changing your theology and your practice, they're the issues again, to accommodate the culture or the spirit of the age. Well, one famous person once said that anyone who marries off himself to the spirit of the age very quickly becomes a widow. We are seeing that when the church decides that rather being salt and light, it will be bland and dim in the world, well, people notice and people leave. Are the numbers necessarily a measure of success, of faithfulness? No, not necessarily. But churches that are not faithful to God's word, who abandon it, who abandon the gospel of Jesus Christ and its saving message, and decide to follow the siren song of the culture, whether they call themselves liberal or not, well, I ask this question. What do they have to offer that the culture can't give bigger and better? I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.